The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Please continue with your meal, but I'd like now to introduce our dean. Claudio Grossman is a professor of law. He's the Raymond Geraldson Scholar for International and Humanitarian Law, and he's been dean of WCL since 1995. He holds memberships in many, many international human rights organizations, and he is chair of the UN Committee Against Torture. He is an international scholar and, what's more important, an international humanitarian. Dean Grossman.
Thank you, Terry, for the introduction, and also for your role in the organization of many of the activities that really make a difference in terms of the type of school where we are, where values of diversity and pluralism are so important and define, in fact, what WCL stands for. In that spirit, I would like to welcome all of you to the 7th Diversity Council Speaker Series Spring Lunch. I would like to thank first the members of the Council, their efforts and promotion of our institutional commitment to diversify the gospel as very important. And the facts of the school, some facts are crucial to assess the success of the institution, not to say that we have completed our task, but I think that we need to take a look at what we have achieved. We are the most diverse top-tier law school in the D.C. metropolitan area and the 6th most diverse top-tier law school in the nation. 40% of our incoming class has identified themselves as members of a minority group, and Hispanic business, for example, the Authoritative Hispanic Foundation, recently recognized our schools as the 3rd best law school in the nation for Hispanic students. I mean, these are the objective standards that show that the commitment to diversity has not stayed simply at the level of rhetoric. And again, one important component of our efforts has been the Council's contribution and commitment to further support our goals. Members of the Council have contributed to our goal beyond internal work of the Council. They also volunteer their time to serve as mentors, lecturers, and role models for our students. Our community greatly values the Council's contribution and look forward to continue our successful partnership long in the future. Shirley Weaver has played an important role here, and we will continue to work and see how we realize and anticipate in our school the type of nation and world where we live, which is essential to perform our educational mission. Now, it is now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, an esteemed member of the Dean's Diversity Council and an alumna of the law school, Chidi Rivadeneira, whose discussion today is entitled, quote, "Safeguarding the Voting Rights of Minority Voters, Potential Impact of Law Students and Lawyers in the 2012 Election," end quote. We are proud to call Ms. Rivadeneira an alumna of our school. Through her work and dedication, she contributes to the promotion and protection of human dignity. She has an extensive experience, including her recent position serving as Deputy Voter Protection Coordinator for then-President-elect Barack Obama's Nevada campaign for change. As a student in our school, Ms. Rivadeneira was committed and driven, participated as a student attorney in our international human rights law training, and volunteering for the Capital Area Immigrant Rights Coalition, where she visited immigrants detained in federal prisons. I remember that Shirley, as a student here, we had numerous conversations with her constant efforts to promote diversity in the law school. We're building blocks that allow us to move further. for her work in the law school and outside the law school. She was awarded in the year 2004 the Peter Chatino Award. And that could not have been more deserved. Her advocacy extends beyond the conventional scope of international human rights, as she has served as chair of the Living Wage Committee as an advocate to low-wage workers fighting for decent pay and higher standards. This commitment is an outgrowth of her time at our law school, where she was involved in the American University Living Wage Campaign also. She was an example when she was here, and she has continued to work in this direction. I also would like to say this. Change is not easy. But it's not simply the result of saying, I'm right, I push, and no matter what happens, this is the right. When we lead people, it's very important to lead them successfully, because the graveyards are full of people who were right but are dead. And when you do not understand that politics is also about bringing the best in human beings, creating and understanding what spaces are there to do things, you really can provide a very negative leadership, as if change is not directed in a good way and doesn't have the possibilities of success, what we get is a backlash and reaction that ended up creating worse situation than the situation of the world. There is a famous Catholic saint and thinker, St. Thomas of Aquino, that established the conditions for a just war. And one of the conditions for the right war, for the just war, is that there is a possibility, there should be a possibility to win. And this is not something, a rhetorical issue. The issue is that if people with a just aspiration are led in a direction that results in defeat, it is much more difficult afterwards to recompose the conditions necessary to move ahead. I mean, defeats bring tremendous effects. And that does not mean that people should become opportunistic, but politics and change require thinking and strategizing, not just being right. And I would say children represent also these values, and in that vein, you know, we're very pleased to receive her back in this to talk with us in our alma mater.
Thank you very much, Dean Grossman and Sherry Olsen, for your warm welcome, and for organizing this kind of diversity luncheons, because they bring up a lot of issues that are very important to minority communities, to students of color, and I'm so glad to see many faces, new students here, taking advantage of these opportunities. And I'm also very, very excited to hear about all the rankings that a lot of publications like the Princeton Review, ABA, Hispanic Business are saying about or placing our law school in. And if we are among the top 10 law schools in the nation to be diverse, that's a tremendous accomplishment. So I would like all of you to, we should all clap for their efforts, for Dean Grossman and Sherry and everyone. As Sherry mentioned, I'm a recent graduate of WCL, and I feel like I've never left the school. And the reason for it is because Sherry and the Office of Diversity Services always make people feel welcome, feeling as you're part of this community, even if you're not longer involved or you never went to WCL. And I've seen that many times with so many people. It's incredible. So thank you for your hospitality. And I'm taking this opportunity also as a family reunion where I get to share a story. And having said that, let me start. I chose to talk today about safeguarding the voting rights of minority voters because of my experience working with the Obama campaign as a deputy voter protection coordinator, first with the state of Georgia and then Nevada. The way things happened, first I was assigned to Georgia. When things didn't go well in terms of the polls, and we were deployed to other places, and I was handed the order to pick up my things, put them in the back of my trunk, and drive for 3 days straight to the state of Nevada. So, and actually, one of the students here, Mariana Kiwan, who's sitting over there, she was sort of she's from Nevada, so we were able to talk a few times. So, I don't know if we talked on the road, but I did try to talk to a lot of people as to what should I expect when I get to Las Vegas. I know the casinos, but besides that, what else is out there? And I know that many of you were also involved in the campaign in one way or another, whether you gave money, whether you registered voters for the first time, or whether you volunteered to monitor a polling location during early voting or on election day. Thank you for your efforts, because you were out there making sure that people got the chance to exercise their right to vote. And you were also out there protecting voters. So from my point of view, thank you. Thank you for your efforts, because it made a big difference. Thank you for that. After seeing witnessing the election of the first African-American president, a lot of people are asking themselves, is voter protection still important? I mean, are minority voters still vulnerable? They shouldn't be, because Barack Obama won overwhelmingly. And as far as we know, the reports say that there were few problems out there. But despite of all that progress that we made this past election, the answer continues to be yes. The answer continues to be yes. Because as you may know from reading your history, our country has sad chapters where voter intimidation has been used against minority communities. And you can count that from Jim Crow all the way to hanging chads in Florida. And the examples abound. So let me read to you. I brought two flyers with me. I'm going to circulate one over here, and you can pass them around. I brought two flyers with me that were circulated in minority communities just 4 years ago. And let me read to you these flyers. The first one comes from Franklin County in Ohio, a county that has a lot of African Americans in that I live in there. And this went out to a lot of households. And it says, Franklin County Board of Elections, election bulletin. Because the confusion caused by unexpected heavy voter registration, voters are asked to apply to the following schedule. Republican voters are asked to vote at your assigned location on Tuesday. Democratic voters are asked to vote at your assigned location on Wednesday. Thank you for your cooperation, and remember, voting is a privilege. If you're a Democratic voter in Franklin County, and you get this flyer, you show up to the polls on Wednesday. That's it. Your right to vote has been taken away from you. So these are the kind of new forms of intimidation going out there that just circulated 4 years ago. Another flyer that made its way to some of our minority voters from the Milwaukee, supposedly from the Milwaukee Black Voters League. And he says, let me read it to you. Some warnings before election time. If you've already voted in any election this year, you cannot vote in the presidential election. If you've ever been found guilty of anything, even a traffic violation, you cannot vote in the presidential election. Wow, I have parking tickets and maybe parking tickets. Wow, that's pretty tough. If anyone in your family has ever been found guilty of anything, you cannot vote in the presidential election. And the word guilty is misspelled, by the way. And if you violate any of these laws, you can get 10 years in prison and your children will get taken away from you. Those are the kind of flyers that circulate out there. And this was just 4 years ago. Okay? So voter intimidation is something that continues to happen and will continue to happen. So for everyone out there who's doubting, who's sort of saying that after President Barack Obama was elected, things will get better. Yes, things will get better, but we need to stay vigilant. We need to stay vigilant. In light of all those flyers, all the problems that we encountered in the past, voter protection was a great concern this year. And it was more so because there was a large, unprecedented numbers of first-time voters, including in particular Latinos, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, who turned to the polls in November in support of Barack Obama. The Democratic National Committee also did not want to see these problems happening again. especially those that we saw in 2000 and 2004, which were long lines, the malfunction of voting machines, not enough emergency paper ballots, and the use of deceptive tactics to turn away minority voters at the polls, like the flyers I just passed around. So in 2006, the DNC began to organize a national voter protection effort, and it involved multiple elements. First, the DNC conducted at a national scale surveys in each county to identify the reasons why this kind of problems were happening and what potential solutions we could come up with. Another component of that effort was to identify local election practitioners, at the most it was one or two at the state level, who had already experience in this area and who could provide assistance at the time the election came. And the last component was to select a group of attorneys and so that they can be deployed to battleground states and work with election officials to resolve those issues. And I was part of one of those teams. Some of the initiatives we were asked to pursue and push for were, for example, getting additional voting machines, assessing the location and number of early voting sites, because in prior years, the few states that hosted early voting placed those sites in golf clubs, in coffee shops that were not accessible to the public. So we needed to push for early voting sites that were more accessible, that were central, that were close to communities that did not have access to transportation. And another big component was also examining official ballots prior to the election so that we wouldn't be surprised on election day with a butterfly ballot like in Florida. So we had to do that too. Another component was to ensure that poll workers received the proper training. And in my area in particular, I also had to make sure that bilingual election materials were available in jurisdictions covered under Section 2 or 3 of the Voting Rights Act. So this massive voter protection initiative had never been attempted before. Or if it had been attempted before, it happened maybe too late, a week or maybe 2 weeks before the general election. So this time around, we had to go out there 4 or 5 months ahead of the election or the general election and get to work on these issues. So in my opinion, the DNC election plan established the foundation for a new kind of voting rights movement, because we were not only concerned with registering voters and getting people out to the polls like in the past, but we also devoted a lot of time and energy to make sure that when everyone showed up to the polls, when every single voter showed up to the polls, that they will be able to cast their ballots without any interference. That's something that we worked really hard to ensure. So as I said, I was fortunate to be selected to join this historic effort and to work in two large states that also have a large number of minority voters, African Americans in Georgia and Latinos in Nevada. And from the moment I arrived on the ground, I knew that my job not only consisted of making sure that all those logistical challenges we experienced in the past were resolved, but also I knew that I needed to reach out to our community leaders and elected officials to collect historical and anecdotal information about past violations of people's voting rights. So, and I have to say that strategy worked also because it allowed us to prevent any future form of voter intimidation, at least the kinds that we were able to stop immediately. And nothing is more powerful than to talk to our leaders, our community leaders, and learn from them firsthand what kind of incidents happened in the past and how often minority voters are disenfranchised. And I would like to read to you a few of the concerns that were shared with me by some of those leaders and elected officials so that you can capture some of the concerns that were still going on up to November and this past November, and probably will continue to occur. One Latino leader told me, there's always been a lack of bilingual poll workers or bilingual assistance at the polls. This has resulted in many poll workers not taking the time to verify Spanish surnames and instead telling Latino voters that they're not on the rolls. Another person also told me, due to a recent wave of anti-immigration sentiment around the country, Latino voters in Nevada may be vulnerable to challenges at the polls based on the false presumption that they are not U.S. citizens or residents of the state. Then another person, too, in Nevada told me that in 2004, some early voting sites in Latino neighborhoods in North Las Vegas were moved without notice. And in Georgia, a preacher told me that in prior elections, there has not been any real effort to educate African Americans and other minorities about their voting rights or where they should go to vote on election day. Another leader also said, after 9/11, the Arab Muslim South Asian community in Georgia was subject to physical and verbal attacks. 7 years after this tragedy, the general public continues to view us and label us as terrorists. As a result, voters in our communities are reluctant to show up to the polls for fear of intimidation and harassment. It was also reported that Arabs, Muslims, South Asians fear going to the polls because they're afraid that poll workers or people outside the precinct are going to take their pictures or ask for their names. And leaders of the Arab, Muslim, South Asian community are requesting help so that people can vote absentee. And the last comment I want to share with you also comes from a Latino leader in Nevada who said that in 2004, a voter hotline that was set up to help Latino voters was inundated with calls from persons who called in to discuss politics or take up time. In the meantime, several people could not get through the hotline to obtain voter registration information or locate their polling place. So those are the things that we encountered. And we needed to do something about this kind of incidents or barriers put in place in front of minority voters. So the things that we tried to tackle those challenges were, for example, publishing early on Know Your Rights information in English and other languages, and that Know Your Rights information contained voter registration requirements, what photo ID people needed to bring to the polls, information for students who wanted to vote in that state, information about absentee ballots, information about for ex-felons who were able to restore their voting rights and needed to vote, and our hotline information, our email information, so that people could get in touch with the campaign and get a sense of what they needed to do before Election Day. We also train our volunteers and our staff on how to properly register voters, because you will be surprised that if you forget to include your date, your date of birth or even date before, your registration is not processed. Your registration is put on hold, and if you're lucky to get a letter from the county election board to rectify, then you can go and correct that information, and then you get to vote. But if not, you show up to the polls, and then you're not on the rolls, and the only option you have left is to vote a provisional ballot. And that's a sad occurrence in our communities, because sometimes people don't have for some reason they move around, our communities are very transient, and they don't get this kind of letters. So we had to make sure that our volunteers, our staff, knew exactly how to fill those voter registration forms. We also launched several media campaigns announcing registration requirements, deadlines, advertising the early voting site locations in those areas that had heavy minority voters. We also recruited and trained volunteers to serve as poll workers. And the reason why we did that, and no offense to senior citizens, but most polling locations have a lot of senior citizens who may not be tech savvy. And now that the technology is changing, there are voting machines out there, and those are being used more often than the paper ballots. We recruited high school students, college students, and other people who had tech-savvy skills, so when they showed up to serve as poll workers, they will be able to keep the line, the voting line, moving, and they will also be able to help with any issues involving machines breaking down or changing a battery on a voting machine, and so that worked pretty well. We also had a, in Nevada at least, we had a bilingual voter hotline dedicated solely to answer voter questions. If people had issues with Barack Obama, if people had other, they wanted to talk about politics, they were transferred to another line, they were transferred to voicemail, and that's how we handle, that's how we handle that. we also, and it, at least in Nevada, I have to say, we advanced a voter education initiative involving Latino children, and the reason for that was because we wanted to engage the young community, young potentially young voters in the future, to learn about the electoral process, and for them also to teach their parents about voting machines and go with their parents and show them how to use the machine so that they can, especially if they didn't speak much English, so that the children could be the guide, their guides. Under federal law, they're entitled to do that. So we pushed for that, those initiatives, and we saw success to some extent. And so as you can see, the TNC election plan and our efforts on the ground reduce a lot of the incidents that in the past people had complained about. And that's potentially, you could argue, many different things, but it, it ensured a victory for President Barack Obama. But I would be lying to you if I told you that everything went as smoothly, that everything was perfect, that we were the saviors of the day, because we still face some new challenges. And this is why I'm here today also, because I want to highlight to you that voter intimidation is taking new shapes and new forms. In Nevada, for example, we received reports that Republicans were making phone calls to Latino households, asking them to, well, pretending first to be part of the Barack Obama campaign, but then asking them to vote over the phone and not to show up at the polls. And we got a lot of those reports, so we immediately acted on those, called the authorities, wrote a couple of memos to them, and launched a massive public service announcement campaign in Spanish radio and TV, alerting the community, warning the community, and telling them, please do not pay attention to these phone calls. Go and vote. That's the only way you can exercise your right to vote. That's the only way you can make a contribution in these elections. So this new incident in Nevada and other voter intimidation tactics that I just discussed today, as I say, it's a sample of the many challenges that are recurring and will continue to occur in the future in our communities. And I guarantee you that these issues will also be much larger, especially after the U.S. The new U.S. Census comes into becomes public, the census of 2010, pardon me. And the reason for that too is because the demographics of our country are already changing. But once those numbers become public, the political map is going to shift dramatically too. Districts are going to be redrawn. Both political parties are going to try to take on new districts. And then new jurisdictions in Virginia, states like Georgia, North Carolina, Arkansas, that have seen a growth of people of color, they're going to be subject to a lot of standards under the Voting Rights Act, and one of them will be to provide bilingual election materials. So those are going to be very challenging. And in the middle of all of this turmoil, the ability of our minority voters to participate in the electoral process will continue to remain at stake. So I'm here today not only to share my experience with you, but also to encourage you to participate in the next elections, or even in the census as well, because it's going to be critical to have minority voters and being represented, or at least being served by minority lawyers or students out there. Sometimes we're the only ones who can understand our community better, or sometimes we're the only ones who can find the courage to speak on their behalf. And if you can donate more than a few days, if you can find time out of your busy lives and the schedule, especially by that time you'll be practicing attorneys, I would encourage you to take 2 to 3 months to get out there on the trenches, not only as a volunteer, but if you can get there as a staff person, if you can be part of one of those state border protection teams, I think that will be tremendous. That will be tremendous, and you will make a huge difference, a huge difference. So having said that, I hope you become involved. I wanted to keep my presentation short to take any questions, so thank you all, and if you have questions, I'm happy to take those now. Thank you. The question was, and I do this for the podcast, what were the issues in terms of photo ID, the ID laws that were passed in terms of in comparing those with Indiana, because Indiana has the strictest photo ID laws in the country. The second one is Georgia. Nevada was actually pretty good, I would have to say, because in Indiana, and I'm trying to remember as much as I can, I'm not an expert on Indiana election law, but in Indiana you have to show your ID from the state of Indiana, and it has to be, it cannot be expired, right? And what else you need to do. And non-photo IDs have to be, for example, your utility bill, but they have to be current. They cannot be from 6 months. They have to be like that month or that, otherwise they won't accept it, right? It's very strict. It's a very strict law. And in Nevada, on the other hand, it was much more lenient because on election day, people were told to, if they had already voted in the past, if people were already residents of the state of Nevada and had voted in the past, they could just go out there. If they give their name out, and they'll be able to vote without any problems. Only if you were a first-time registrant, if it was the first time voting, you had to show your ID, and that's it. At times, there were questions about people, because people move from place to place. We were also advising folks to bring their utility bills, even if it was, from the past 6 months. So we advised those things. So the law in Nevada was more lenient compared to Indiana. And that's also another challenge in terms of our electoral system in the U.S., because there are different rules for every county and for every state. So that's why for the DNC it was so important to have also on the ground, local election attorneys who worked with our team to address all those issues about photo ID, what does this county do, what kind of letters this county send, and are those legal, because there were even letters sent from the county threatening people with, that they could go to jail for 10 years if they falsify information. And yes, under the law, if you falsify your voting registration information, and you can be penalized, but if you use that language in a letter, the community gets pretty intimidated. Let's see. Did I answer your question? Okay. Yes.
Hi. So you've talked about some of the tactics that are out there that other groups are using, but how responsive have you found the authorities to be when you do report these violations? Have you noticed a change that they're much more on top of it, or are they just kind of like, whatever, it's the voter registration thing, I've got to deal with these crimes going on? So that was just what I was wondering.
Right. And the question was, how responsive are the local authorities to this kind of voter intimidation reports that are made? The answer says it depends on the jurisdiction. And the reason for it, and I can give you, depends also who's running the government of that state. In Georgia, for example, there were not that many Democrats in the local government, and we were we had to really battle a lot of problems with the Secretary of State for Georgia. I mean, she was just not helpful at all. For example, the website of the Secretary of the State of Georgia had even misleading information that was not even in line with what the Georgia statute said about how the election should be won. So you wouldn't imagine that if we had also made reports about voter intimidation, that they will do something. So our basis was in Georgia to report it also to the DOJ, to the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, so that at least there will be some federal presence if we encounter those problems too. In Nevada, on the other hand, there was some responsiveness, but a lot of it had to deal with the fact that there's a lot of Democratic leaders at many levels, and they were very responsive to our concerns. Also, I think Nevada is changing the state in the sense that they are aware now that their Latino population is pretty large and is a huge constituency, so they cannot turn a blind eye. They have to deal and directly with that issue. So you can see that it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So he was first in the Nevada team.
I've got great respect for the work you did in trying to prevent voter intimidation. But and I'm pleased that I was able to do a little of that myself on Election Day. I was with the Lawyers Committee, their election protection thing. And so I think it's important work. It's necessary work. But it's I can't help thinking it's also sort of marginal work. Because, yes, there are bad actors out there, but the real problem, I think, in terms of minority voter turnout and for low-income voter turnout in its entirety, is that poor people still pay something very like a poll tax. If you're working an hourly wage, you need to very often take time off from work to go vote. And a lot of people just can't afford that.
Right.
So I guess what I'd like to know is, and obviously this is more of a policy question, so it may not be a fair one to ask, but did you get any sense when you were working on the campaign whether the administration would support something like, you know, what many jurisdictions have for jury duty, where if you're called to jury duty, you get employers have to pay you for the time you miss? Is there any possibility of...
Well, there's the Help America Vote Act of 2002, that and in the original bill there were some propositions like yours to give people a day off. And kind of goes back to the same answer that I gave you, depends on also the jurisdiction. And we also dealt with that issue in Nevada, because the Nevada statute does provide a day off, or at least if you're a union member, it says that your union leader or your employer has to give you some hours in between so you can make it to the polls and travel to the polls and back to work.
Paid or unpaid?
I have to look back to the statute to look to see if it was paid or unpaid. So if those issues involving people being able to take time off were crucial. That's why this year, thank goodness, there was a lot of early voting going on, and that allowed people to go during the weekends. Some states I think Virginia started their early voting cycle like after Labor Day, and continue through all the way till the last weekend before November 4th. And so that has been another way in which some states are trying to tackle that issue, trying to tackle providing many, many opportunities for voters to be able to cast their ballots without having to impede on their, you know, their livelihood or their ability to make ends meet. But I think for the next administration, for now, we're going to have to push for a revision of the Help America Vote Act and see if there are any additional things we can do. There's so much you can do at the federal level because elections are still being controlled at the state level. So you have this constitutional, I would say, dilemma. So that's a big challenge. Oh, sorry.
I was just wondering if there's been any efforts to kind of cross party lines and make this more of a bipartisan issue. I know the Democratic National Party has been heavily involved in it, but I'm sure there are some Republicans out there that care about voter protection rights as well. So I wonder if there's been any efforts to...
The question was whether there have been any efforts to run voter protection as a bipartisan effort instead of a partisan effort. In addition to our campaign running voter protection, there are also groups like the Lawyers Committee, and the ACLU and a bunch of other organizations running nonpartisan voter protection work. And that's where a lot of both registered Republicans and registered Democrats who did not want to align themselves with any of the political parties, that's where they were sent most of the time. Now, what I understand the Republican Party does, they don't call their efforts voter protection. They call their efforts voter fraud prevention, because I don't want to be electioneering here, but they just think that the Democratic Party is out there trying to get people to vote through illegitimate means, and that's not the case. So you can see that there's different ideologies when it comes to how the parties look at election law. But if people don't want to be tangled on either of those sides of the debate, they can choose to be nonpartisan, and those opportunities are out there too. Anyone else? Oh, go ahead,
last question. I know you talked about the early vote, And I think that their early vote was unavailable in somewhere between 15 and 20 states this past election. And do you think it would be something that would be feasible or desirable to have an early vote become mandatory for all states as something maybe in a revised version of the HAVLA Act?
If HAVLA can provide funding, I think that's one way that you can kind of put pressure so that those other states could also implement early voting in their states. But I think also it was good that we had such a good turnout during early voting this year and in so many states, because those other ones who did not offer it will see that it saves you time, it saves you trouble. It also makes things go much more smoothly. And so I think it will be just a matter of each of the states now looking at what happened in 08 and trying to adopt that measure on their own. But if HAVLA funds could be also used as a way to leverage or put a little bit of pressure, I think that's how it could probably be done. Okay. Well, thank you. I don't know. Thank you.
As one of those elderly people working polls, we really appreciate your effort. We certainly do appreciate your remarks here today, my dear. It's so good to have you back.
It's so good to be here.
And we have a special presentation by Ms. Emily Sala of the Latino Law Students Association.
I don't know if this is a presentation, but I wanted to say Shirley, thank you. We really appreciate all that you've done, and then also the fact that you've taken the time out of your day to come here to speak with us. I wanted to, on behalf of the entire Latino Law Students Association, offer you a small token of our thanks.
Oh, thank you. We're always supportive of all the LALSA and and thank you for your efforts too. Thank you. Helping out.
Thank you, Emily. Finally, I'd like to put a couple of other things on your radar, a couple of other events. On March 5th, Hispanic Law Conference number 12, I believe this is. April 2nd, the 13th Sylvania Woods Conference on African Americans and the Law. On April 7th, the Modern American Symposium. So watch the docket for information about all those. Oh, and on Monday, whatever's 2 weeks from today, the 23rd, I guess, we'll be having the clinical diversity luncheon for people who are interested in clinical work. So thank you all for coming. Thank you for the really good questions. And enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Watch the docket.